This is Jim Cotter. Welcome to our Creatively Speaking show archive. Our ability to present these programs online is supported by WRTI's listener members. If you're already a member, thanks so much. If you're not a member, why not, while you're listening, click on the Become a Member link on the left of all WRTI.org webpages. Your support is vital to ensure we can continue to produce this and all of the other programming you hear on WRTI. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello. On this week's program, we look ahead to two concurrent exhibitions of works by the great 20th century American painter Daniel Garber. The shows open at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts and the James A. Michener Art Museum in Doylestown this weekend. We'll speak with PAFA senior curator Lynn Marsden Atlas. As the Grand Old Lady of Locust Street hits the big 150, Susan Lewis looks at celebrations of a century and a half of the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. Jason Pfeiffer visits the ArtReach organization. Part of its mission is to help underserved audiences experience arts and culture. The Philadelphia-based group celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Daniel Garber rose to prominence in the early 20th century as an impressionist painter. An Indiana native, he studied formerly at the Art Academy of Cincinnati and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia. Garber financed his education by working as an illustrator, commercial artist, and portrait painter. After studying on a scholarship in Europe, Garber returned to Pennsylvania to settle near Lumberville, 6 miles from New Hope. Garber's scenes are rich with blues, greens, and yellows, and often overlaid with extensive surface patterning. Through these techniques, he created a style of landscape painting characterized by romanticized representational imagery. Though he received numerous awards worldwide for his work, Garber did not rest on his laurels, instead choosing to use his gifts to nurture the talents of others, spending upwards of 40 years as a teacher at both the Philadelphia School of Design for Women and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Two major Garber retrospectives open this weekend. The Academy will show works from the first half of Garber's career, while the James A. Michener Art Museum in Doylestown will focus on the final part of the artist's life. Earlier this week, I met with senior Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts curator, Lynn Marsden Atlas. Where does Daniel Garber rate in the pantheon of the great Bucks County Impressionists and later artists?
From my point of view, he is really at the top. I think he's perhaps... Other people may refute this. They may say Redfield or Schofield, but I really see Daniel Garber at the peak.
What's particular to his style of painting?
Well, Garber was an exceptionally renowned artist, probably at the stature of someone like, for us today, you know, Andrew Wyeth or Jasper Johns, of that level of renown during his lifetime. He won most of the prizes at every single major institution. He was collected by major museums all over the country.
But he went a little out of fashion later in the century.
It's absolutely true. After there was a real turning point in his professional career, I think less due to the fact that there are two elements to that. After 1929, his work was less purchased. He was less fashionable. And really the reason for that is twofold. The Depression. And the other, really a phenomenon of changing tastes, it's 1929 in the early 30s that we see the birth of the Museum of Modern Art and the Whitney Museum, which was called the Museum of Non-Objective Art in New York. And so the fashion for museums in terms of what was the new wave was certainly abstraction and influenced very heavily by European surrealism and abstraction. So, which brought in a new wave of abstract expressionism. So, if you will, Daniel Garber's reputation and his active collectors probably turned more to abstract art. And it's really only until the late 1980s and 90s that he has become again renowned. And this, of course, is the first retrospective. Kathy Foster did a wonderful show in 1980 and presented new scholarship then. But other than that, we haven't had a show, a retrospective of Daniel Garber since 1945 when it was here at the Academy.
Unusually for many painters, Garber was a very accomplished both landscape painter and portrait painter. Are there examples that you would particularly say are must-sees to people who are coming to the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts part of this show?
What's so fascinating is we have brought the whole show here in Bucks County at the Michener. We gathered 170 of his top paintings. There are over 800 paintings, by the way. 170 paintings and charcoal drawings, many from private collections, many from major institutions all over the country, from California east. This is right behind me. It is an amazing must-see. This is in a private collection, the Warner Company in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. This is called Tanis. Now, unlike the American Impressionists, who were also interested in light and reflection and painting, this is a scene of Daniel Garber. This is Garber's daughter, Tanis, when she's about 8 or 9 years old. And what's so wonderful about this piece is she's standing in the doorway, literally, of the French doors of his studio out at Catalasa on this incredibly abundant, bright, beautiful, luminous summer day. And you see the light and reflection coming through. She's wearing she's wearing a dress, and over it there's a little smock. And what you see is the light coming through the smock and her head in profile. Unlike the Impressionist, who really focused on seizing one moment at a particular time of day, Garber and doing it in very quickly executed work, Garber actually worked on this painting for 3 months. Through the entire summer, June, July, and August of the summer.
And set it, I think, at midday, just judging by the shadows
exactly.
That are below her. Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts Senior Curator Lynn Marsden Atlas. Daniel Garber, Romantic Realist, opens today at PAFA and runs through April 8th. The companion exhibition at the James A. Michener Art Museum in Doylestown opens tomorrow and runs through May 6th. This weekend, the nation's oldest continuously operating opera house hits a milestone 150 years. As WRTI's Susan Lewis reports, the much-beloved Academy of Music returns to her roots with a grand ball and an eclectic concert featuring everything from rock stars to royalty.
Philadelphia in 1850 was a small city but a thriving American center of commerce and culture. What Philadelphia did not have, however, was a grand house for opera, an art form that signaled a city's stature among the cultural elite. Ambitious Philadelphians wanted a venue to rival European opera houses like La Scala in Milan. So, they built one. Money was raised through a stock offering. Architects Napoleon Lebrun and Gustav Runge were found through a competition. Together, they would build an opulent opera house, but one with just over 2,900 seats, not the 5,000-seat hall originally hoped for.
Gustav Runge knew about opera houses, and he said you couldn't build a 5,000-seat opera house on two accounts. One, it was too expensive. And two, the acoustics and the relationship between the audience and the stage would be too far away.
Hi Myers is an architect who has been doing restoration work at the Academy since 1979, when it was decided to return the decor to its 1857 style. In 1857, to save money, a compromise was made. The exterior would be simple, but belie an opulent interior in a Rococo Baroque style, complete with marbleized lobby walls, crystal chandeliers, and statuary. Maureen Lynch, the Academy's operations manager, says there was a spiritual aspect to this temple of music.
As you enter the building, you come to an outer lobby, then a wonderful, gracious, large lobby with steps that go up to the upper levels, broad and open for people to mingle. Then you enter into an ambulatory before you get into the main theater, or in the mystical sense, where the ritual of the spirit happens.
The interior auditorium is shaped like an open horseshoe, a sea of red velvet seats surrounded by tiers of balconies rising up to a glorious domed, painted mural-covered ceiling from which is suspended a giant chandelier 50 feet in circumference. A bust of Mozart is flanked by figures representing poetry and music above the proscenium arch. Aside from the glamour of its form, the Academy was, when it was built, also the state-of-the-art in function. It had modern gas lighting, heating, and fire protection in the form of multiple exits, so many, in fact, that the 1857 building still meets contemporary fire exit codes. Its function was also remarkably like modern-day multi-use performing arts centers. Its design accommodated concerts, graduations, lectures, political conventions, even a football game between Princeton and Penn. The Academy opened, in fact, on January 26, 1857, with a promenade concert and a grand ball, not in the ballroom, but in the auditorium itself. The floor extended from the stage over the seats to the back of the house. Naturally, there have been many operas at the Academy. The American premieres of Verdi's Il Trovatore, Gounod's Faust, Strauss's Ariana auf Naxos, and Wagner's The Flying Dutchman. There were performances of ballet and theater, visits by dignitaries like the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VII, Winston Churchill, and U.S. presidents. The Academy was, in some ways, a building of rich and ultimately enriching contradictions. Called an academy, it never became a school, as once contemplated. Built as an opera house, its most enduring and famous tenant would be not an opera company, but the Philadelphia Orchestra. The Philadelphia Orchestra premiered in 1900 under the baton of its first music director, Fritz Scheel. After Scheel came Carl Polig and then the reign of Leopold Stokowski. Early guest conductors and soloists included Sergei Rachmaninoff, Gustav Mahler, and Arturo Toscanini. During World War II, the Academy adapted again, transforming its lower level into a stage door canteen where musicians and actors from all over town, people like Frank Sinatra, would come and entertain the GIs. Philadelphia artists painted murals on the walls, and Philadelphia Orchestra and Academy board members waited tables, says High Myers.
So Robert Montgomery Scott was a waiter, and Walter Annenberg was a bartender.
In the 1950s, the orchestra bought the Academy, as Linda Scribner, director of principal gifts for the Philadelphia Orchestra and Academy of Music, describes.
In 1957, the building had really fallen into total disrepair. And a group of local businessmen got together, and they said, you know, we've got to save this building. And that's really how the Restoration Fund started.
This evening's gala marks the 150th anniversary of the Grand Old Lady. The theme is generations, which works well not only with the generations of Philadelphians who have come here, says Linda Scribner, but with the royal visit by Charles, today's Prince of Wales, whose great-grandfather, also the Prince of Wales, later Edward VII, came in 1860.
He was following Adelina Patti, who was a fabulous opera singer, and he went incognito as Lord Renfrew, was seated in the proscenium box. From that day forward, the box has been named the Prince of Wales Box.
In 1963, the Academy was designated a historic landmark. Today, the orchestra still owns the Academy, but has moved down the street to a new, purpose-built concert hall in the Kimmel Center, where audience and ensemble sit in the same room. The Academy, in turn, now serves as it was originally intended, as an opera house for opera, ballet, and theater, hosting both local and touring productions. But the Academy, however grand its architecture, is more than a building. However impressive the roster of entertainers, it's also more than a performance space.
I've been here 34 years. Many of our ushers have been here 30 years. Some of them have married, and now their children are also ushers right alongside of them. If you're here 20 years, you're the baby of the group.
I can remember my first ballet was there watching Margot Fonteyn and Swan Lake.
Everybody just has such fond memories of this beautiful building.
Why is the Academy not just another old building? Why has it endured? In part because of its flexible, forward-looking design. In part because of its history, but mostly the Academy has endured because the people of Philadelphia, just like those of 150 years ago, need a great temple to the arts, which is still part of what it means to be a great city.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Tonight's 150th anniversary Academy Ball and Concert features a broad array of entertainers, from Christoph Eschenbach and the Philadelphia Orchestra to rock musician Rod Stewart, actor John Lithgow, and former news anchor Tom Brokaw. The Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall will be the evening's distinguished guests. For many, the arts are a central part of life. Because personal creative expression or experiencing the creativity of others can be entertaining, invigorating, and inspiring, museum exhibitions, concerts, plays, and dance performances are regular events for so many. But for some, access to artistic outlets and venues is often out of reach. Physical and economic barriers are a seemingly insurmountable impediment. One Philadelphia-based organization that aims to remove some of these barriers and make the arts a more consistent part of life for everyone is ArtReach. It celebrates its 20th anniversary this year, and as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, its services are wide-reaching and expanding.
ArtReach was started in 1986 on the basis of some simple realities. There are many unused tickets for performing and visual art events in the Philadelphia region, And many people rarely have the opportunity to see a play or go to a museum. ArtReach was designed to bridge the gap between these realities. Michael Norris is the executive director of ArtReach.
The idea is to give people who don't normally have access to cultural opportunities a chance to really experience what the arts are all about, both as audience members and as participants.
Norris says there are about 100 arts organizations that participate in ArtReach's core program to distribute donated and discounted tickets. Institutions like the Kimmel Center, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Pennsylvania Ballet, and the Arden Theater. And nearly 150 member organizations use the ticketing resource, from health service agencies to community groups to after-school programs. St. Mary Interparochial School in Philadelphia is one group that frequently works with ArtReach to expose young students to arts and culture. The school's art coordinator, Donna Bridey, says that for many economically disadvantaged children, an outing to a museum or performance event through the school often serves as their introduction to visual and performing arts. And it creates enthusiasm among the kids.
They have a vocabulary now that they didn't before. Because many times when we do take advantage of something during the day, I prepare them before they go there. That already plants a seed in their mind, and then they go out to see the performance or whatever, and then we talk about it when they come back. And it really sticks. Now, sometimes when I'm giving a class, I can't even get through what I'm supposed to be covering because they all start raising their hands, say, oh, remember when, and oh, we saw that.
In addition to class trips during the day, Donna Bridey says that ArtReach also enables the school to offer tickets to entire families for evening and weekend events. She says these donated tickets and discounts are very popular, as many families find that experiencing art together can oftentimes be expensive.
They are very sought after by the parents because it may be the only exposure that they'll be able to provide their children at this time.
Besides easing some of the financial challenges of experiencing arts and culture, ArtReach is also dedicated to working with special needs audiences. These include individuals with physical or mental disabilities and the elderly, who simply may not be able to get out much. Executive Director Michael Norris notes that enabling such community members to be an active part of the art world establishes an important mindset.
We've helped them think of going to cultural events as something that they have every right to do as much as you or I do.
Although helping underserved audiences get out to cultural events has been a central goal of ArtReach from its inception, over the years the organization's services have been expanded to bring art to people. ArtReach works with about 50 freelance artists, storytellers, musicians, dancers, and actors who will visit, say, a community center or a school to share their creative work. Sometimes the artist visit will merely involve a performance for those gathered. But in other cases, the artist will come and run a hands-on workshop, inviting people to participate in the arts, not just be a spectator. For instance, ArtReach is presently coordinating a residency workshop in the Norris Square neighborhood of North Philadelphia. Through the collaboration of the Norris Square Neighborhood Project, the Norris Square Senior Center, the Interact Theater Company, and the Mural Arts Program, a group of teenagers and senior citizens have been meeting together on Tuesday afternoons since September. Together, they're designing a new mural for their park square and creating a play that reflects the stories and history of the neighborhood. On alternating weeks, a mural artist and a theater artist meet with the teens and seniors to explore the different elements of the art forms.
What I want to do today is just talk about a play, like what's involved in the actual play in the theater, and then specifically the writing of a play. So how many of you have ever seen theater?
Deborah Block from the Interact Theater Company runs the theater component of the Norris Square Residency and is helping the group develop a play. In her view, this sort of project has very far-reaching implications.
What I'm hopefully doing is, as they're coming up with their ideas, what you can do, to realize that they can be the creators of art. It is not something that is separate from them. It is very easy for them to create ideas, and their ideas can be put up on the stage, and they're valid. They feel comfortable expressing their ideas. And in the safety of this kind of environment, hopefully will give them confidence so that when they're out in the world, they can do that as well.
One teenage participant in the weekly gathering is Adelina Hernandez. She says that while she hopes to one day work in the medical field, her experiences in art projects like this residency have helped her discover a joy for painting.
It helps me express myself because in certain things you can't express yourself. So those certain things I could do it, but in other places I can't. So that helps me relieve my madness and stuff like that.
Others in the group have come to see some practical benefits of helping to create art for the community. Saul Zayas envisions the new mural having an impact on a nearby park.
Maybe if people see our mural and it's supposed to be beautiful, that's like the main thing about it. It has a tree, animals, and it's supposed to be clean, like, so that when they see our mural, it's supposed to tell them that our park is supposed to be the same way. It's supposed to be clean and beautiful.
The Norris Square Mural and Theater Residency will culminate in April, with the theater production being performed in front of the new mural, both designed with input from the teenagers and senior citizens, which, when you think about it, really brings the work of ArtReach full circle. Not only does the organization enable people to go see and experience arts and culture, it's also grown to help people create their own art and bring it themselves to their community.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Catherine Blodgett and Dominic Mercier. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.